I'd like now to welcome Anne Armbrecht. She is the author of the book Thin Places, A Pilgrimage Home, and she will be speaking tonight at Collected Works Bookstore from 6 o'clock on. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
This is a very interesting book. You are an anthropologist, but it's not really a work of anthropology. It's as much a personal narrative and meditation as anything. Mm-hmm. You went to northeastern Nepal. You were a doctoral student at Harvard. What were you studying, first of all?
I had gone to northeastern Nepal to look at the villagers' relationship to the land in the context of a national park and conservation area. So I was interested in what they thought about this international project, and I was curious about the impacts it would have on their communities. When I got there, I found out, in fact, they didn't think a lot about the project. What mattered much more was their whole system of land tenure, and so my research actually focused a lot more on land rights and a customary system of land tenure.
So one of the things that's so interesting about the book is that when you are an American who shows up in some other part of the world, you think you know what your questions are, but your questions actually change in the course of your work there.
Mm-hmm. And before I was going, I went to speak with William Cronin, who's an American historian, about doing my research. And he said everybody sees the world through a black box, through sort of the analytical framework through which we perceive things. And he said when the information you learn in Harangna doesn't fit into the box, get rid of your box, rather than the information, which is the case of most ethnographic research. You come with these categories and ideas about what matters and what's important, and then you're thrown into life and you find your feet as best you can.
So how did their traditional methods of land use and their way of resolving disputes and using the land, how did that work?
Well, they were rice growers on terraced fields and subsistence rice farmers, and they plowed with oxen, water buffalo and oxen, and the system of how they got right. There were a lot of land disputes in the area, which I sort of went with these ideas that, with romanticized ideas about customary systems of tenure, that they have great ways of working it out that are much more effective than private property. And of course I found it was much more complicated, and that the fields that were highly productive were much more contested than the fields that weren't so productive. And so there were land disputes over those.
Which is not really surprising if you think about it.
No, not at all.
And so how did they actually resolve disputes? What happened when you have communally owned land, how do you decide who gets the rights, who gets to use it?
Different ways. There's a story, there are these two stories about the founding of the village, and one is about them sort of coming to this sacred spring and drinking from that water and swearing to stay at home. And then the older men in the village would follow that up with a story about those same two brothers having to decide who was going to get which land. And one tricked the other out of the land by cutting wood that looked old really quickly, and he staked those claims next to the other one's posts, and he said, that's my land. And those practices would continue up into the present. People would say, this rock is the border of my field, and that would be what was written down. And in fact, it was another rock that was further over. And so then whoever was able to press that claim, either with the village headman or in the district court, would get rights to that land until someone else would come along and say, well, no, this trail over here is the border of the field. So it was a constant kind of negotiation between neighbors and relatives.
And as you say in the book, a lot of it had to do with who had the best narrative and was best at delivering that.
Yes. Yes.
So one of the things that comes up in your narrative is what happens when national or international conservation organizations with all the best intentions go into a place where they don't really understand the traditional ways of using land, the traditional ways of life. And even if they pay lip service to wanting to preserve indigenous culture, they don't even know how to do it because they don't know what that indigenous culture is about.
Well, and even when you do know something about this project where I was working, they did a lot of research about the cultural traditions and even about Kipat, the traditional system of land tenure and how it gave access to grazing rights and all of that. But it's so, you know, it's like any community. It's incredibly complicated on the ground, and it's often a struggle, especially when something like land is the issue, which is what everybody needed in order to keep their family alive. It's an incredibly contested resource. And so in this case, the national park came in, and essentially the national government got control rights to the resources that the villagers had. Their whole cultural tradition was about saying the king couldn't touch those lands. And suddenly the king, in fact, could touch the land under the name of preserving biodiversity and sustainable development. And so it's just complicated. And
so what happened, and what was your role in, I mean, you were a student, but did you have some kind of active role in helping to sort it out?
It was interesting. Before I went to the field, another thing William Cronin said was, I was very naive about my ability to change anyone's thinking. And he said, you know, the most you can do is show others that the fence means X, Y, and Z. And then they'll probably pause and understand that it means X, Y, and Z and continue to do what they were going to do anyway. Which touches on a bigger theme, I think, that I'm trying to talk about in Thin Places, which is how we stay open to information that doesn't fit what we think it should mean or how it should be.
Well, it's a very important thing, and it's hard to do justice to your book in such a short time that we have here on the radio, because there is so much subtlety to that. It takes a really long time for a person who comes in with a language and a set of assumptions, and even if you learn another language, to really understand how other people think and how different it is from your own.
Yeah. And I think when I think about it now and what I came away with is you can't ever really know another culture. You know, I know certain people from Hadangna, some whom I came to know pretty well, and that's what I think I know, those individuals and those relationships in that moment in time. And then to jump from that, and certain people have to, and for making policy and changes and programs, you need to be able to jump to larger levels of talking about culture on a different scale. I'm not comfortable doing that. I'm much more comfortable talking about my encounters with Devi Maya or Chorti Rai or Baiseti Tuma.
There's a very, to me, poignant moment where you, the student, went to your advisor at Harvard, and the advisor said to you, Anne, don't think that everything that happens there is important. Some of it isn't. And that seemed to be such a slap in the face of your experience there, where you really were taking in everything. You were taking in the language and smells and sounds and the expressions on people's faces and what their skin was like and what they asked you and what you asked them, and then to be told that's not important.
It
seemed to
be
part of sort of the way that academia can be quite callous.
Interesting word, yeah.
We're talking to Anne Armbrecht about her book, Thin Places, A Pilgrimage Home. Let's talk about that word, pilgrimage. Mm-hmm. To what extent, what do you, when you go to Nepal, pilgrimage is a term that has kind of a religious significance to it. You're looking for some kind of spiritual connection. How was that for you?
I definitely went to Nepal looking for some spiritual connection. You know, my reasons were land tenure and all of that, but I personally was looking for some deeper essence. And I definitely had the idea that it was residing in the Himalayan mountains. And what I found there informed that, but not in the ways I expected it. And that became clear when I went back on different trips later to return to Hadangna, and I didn't find there what I thought I was going to find there. And I realized that it wasn't about the place nearly as much as it was about what that place evoked in me or how I was in that place. And there's the founding story that I mentioned before about the villagers coming to Hadangna. And they travel down through the landscape searching for a wooden bowl and walking stick that they'd thrown into a lake high in the Himalayan mountains. And so they're being led by the ancestors, that is the idea, in the wooden bowl and walking stick that disappear underneath the earth. And they're traveling across the landscape, and the story says over and over, watching, watching, walking, walking. which to me just captures this quality of paying attention as you move. And they had the intention of finding home. But then it emerged at one place, and they looked around, and it didn't look so great. And so they threw it back in.
And that, I thought that was an amazing moment in that story. It's not quite a creation myth, but it has sort of that feeling that people, you know, they're waiting for this magical thing to happen, and a walking stick and a bowl emerge from the lake. And then they look around and say, oh, we don't like this place. We'll try again.
Yeah, I love that. And then they did throw it back in, and it emerged further down the valley, and they climbed up a tree, and they looked around, and the land looked better, and so they decided they would stay there. But so that, to me, that captures this idea of a pilgrimage, of how you are in the world. And again, I think of the quotation from Virginia Woolf that I start with, there are moments when the walls of our mind grow thin and nothing is unabsorbed, and that kind of permeability between ourself and the world around us. That you don't have to go to the Himalayan mountains to find that.
Right.
It's more accessible there, but I think it's also more accessible anytime we're away from the routines and structure of our home.
There is, inside the narrative, a whole story about your marriage and your relationship with your husband and how that goes on and parallels your being home and away, and he also does land conservation, but in a different way. And it was very interesting to me to look at the differences between how you and he articulated and experienced these things as kind of a microcosm of some big picture. So here he was, this man who articulated in a very clear and charismatic way how he thought that people should relate to the land, or you can say this better than I, but he had very clear ideas, whereas yours were much more in a process of being formed, and I think probably a lot more subtle. And it was hard for you for those ideas to really stand up in the face of his clarity.
Yeah.
And it seems like that could be kind of a metaphor for example, U.S. land conservation ethics when they put them on indigenous people.
Yeah, and so much, you know, clarity. And in those land disputes, people who were clear, they won the land. And on our trip around the United States, when, you know, I'd have these images that would come to me from dreams or just not from the normal way of accessing information, but it was very hard to translate that into the narrative that we were, the ways of telling stories that we were on the trip to tell. And some of that was also my lack of confidence in these other ways of knowing. I think that's also what I concluded, that you need both a lot of different kinds of stories. And often when I read about storytelling and the importance of stories, it seems to suggest there's one kind that's going to take care of us, and they're not all that way. Some are, like the stories of Kipot are about some villagers taking care of themselves more than others, whereas other stories were about connecting with some sacred essence.
And the importance of stories in how we see ourselves and how we relate to the land is something that's really brought out. And the fact is, some of these stories aren't really true. There are a lot of romanticized stories about people who went back to the land and built their house and collected their herbs. And everybody who goes there says, oh, gee, we should live like that. But they're not even doing it. And you bring out those, I mean, maybe it's too much to call them lies, but sort of inconsistencies and untruths in a way that's quite beautiful.
Oh, thanks. I think what I'm really trying to understand with that is, you know, clearly we have to change how we're living on the land. But we know a lot about what we should do as a culture. And, you know, there's lots of things, some things I do, and there's lots of things I don't do, even though I know I should do something else. And I really want to understand what motivates people to keep doing, making the changes to grow their own food or to buy organic food or whatever it is, and what makes us stop, what makes us give up. And it feels like in that tension between those two, there is something we can learn about how to, like, the cultural dimensions of sustainability. Peter Matheson was once speaking at the Watershed Gathering, or Fire and Grit, which is organized by Orion Magazine, and he quoted Solzhenitsyn, sorry, I can't say it, and that the line through good and evil cuts through each of our hearts. And who of us, I don't have this correct, but who of us is willing to cut out our own heart? And so just that in each of us we have the capacity for love and forgiveness and for destruction and hatred. And that's, again, this idea of pilgrimage seems like a way of working with that, rather than if you go live off the land, that's the answer. Because we're all going to sort of fall off the wagon some in how you work with that.
And when you talk about living off the land, it's not easy.
Right.
It's not easy in northeastern Nepal when you've been doing it for 500 years, and it's not easy in Maine, and it's not easy in New Mexico.
Right.
So did your work and writing this book, I mean, how did it change you and change the way you see issues of land use and land conservation?
I think I went to Hidangna looking for also some, I thought indigenous cultures had some wisdom that we had lost, and as I've been saying, it was more complicated. But I did find something in how they related to the land, in large part because they can't manipulate it and control it and change it the way other countries with different levels of technology are able to. And so they're forced to recognize the limits of what they can control, rather than the extent of their control. And so then, what do you do in the face of what you can't control? How do you act? And I think that's, again, it goes back to this question of pilgrimage and how to move in a world that it's a living entity, I guess, that the ancestors are living in their landscape for them. But there's an animating force in the landscape where we are as well. And so how do we live in a way that honors and makes room and doesn't put power over that? And that's also why I talked about my marriage, because I think how we relate to other people is inextricably connected to how we relate to the environment, that they're both a sort of other with a capital O. And so do we do that with humility and respect, or with trying to control and change that person to fit what our vision is?
There's a somewhere in the book you talked about that this worldview that you found in this village that you were in Nepal didn't distinguish between the political and the sacred. And I thought that was an amazing thing to really hold and contemplate for us.
Yeah.
I mean, how did they? What did that look like there?
Well, there, so they had the sacred spring, which is known as the Tsawa, which is kind of like a spiritual address when the shamans go on a journey to rescue lost souls from the ancestors. They identify the individual by naming this Tsawa, which is a physical place in the landscape, and it kind of identifies them as members of this community, the Yakaba, Ayamfu Rai. In order to hold land as kipat, you had to have a yamfu rai, had to have a tsawa. And so the kipat kind of extended the cultural, the sacred connection with the land out onto the political landscape.
When you think about that, we can't take that and translate it directly into land use policy in New Mexico. What can we do with it?
I know it's hard even to describe and to get my mind around it again when I haven't sort of been in Hidangna lately,
right,
trying to understand it. I think it's in part why I've been drawn to the work of traditional herbalism since I've come back to the United States, and current work I'm doing is much more related to that, because that's a land use, a way of working with the land and harvesting resources from the land that is based on this sacredness of those plants. Or not even the sacredness, it's that there's a living spirit in those plants. And so how do you collect and harvest and prepare medicines that don't destroy that living essence? And certainly lots of farmers, you know, on a smaller scale, do that. Once things get to a larger scale, it becomes so much more difficult.
Mechanized, and it's not quite as much of a living.
Right.
Anne Armbrecht is the author of the book Thin Places, A Pilgrimage Home, and she will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow we will be with Robert Knott and much more. Just keep your dial tuned to Santa Fe's only public radio station, KSFR. Ciao.